This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of rock and roll, only on KBOO Portland.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. With award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on Who Owns Our Food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to illihi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an update on week 2 of Mohammed Mohammed's terrorism trial.
City Commissioner Amanda Fritz proposes a rule that requires all Portland businesses to provide at least 40 hours of sick leave to employees.
And protesters call on General Motors to respond to Colombian workers' demands at the Portland Auto Show.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Portland Auto Show began today at the Convention Center, and it was met by protests calling on General Motors to respond to the demands of Colombian workers who've been injured while working for GM but have never received workers' comp. Instead, the workers say that GM has targeted them with firings and harassments for trying to organize for their rights. Jorge Parra, one of the workers, has sewn his mouth shut and is on his 65th day of a hunger strike in support of the Association of Injured GM Workers in Colombia. KBOO's Jamie Partridge went to the auto show today in Portland and managed to speak with both protesters and representatives of General Motors.
That's the sound of a Lamborghini right here in the showroom. I'm walking down the lane of the high-end models here, Rolls-Royce, Cadillac, Bentley. So I'm here talking with Diana, product specialist, and looking around at the new line of trucks and sedans. And there was some protesters outside asking about a situation in Colombia with injured workers that were kicked to the curb, apparently fired for being injured on the job. Do you know anything about that?
I do not.
Can't tell me anything about that. Okay. Any other last words for our listeners about what's happening with your display and the show here this week?
Well, I just would say come on out. We're here until Sunday, and we'd love to share our new technology and advancements with the public. As I said, Oregon is one of our greenest states, and we love Oregon because we released, like, the Volt was released here in Oregon first, and we're doing that with the EV. So it's really important for people to know that we really love Oregon.
All right, talking with Deanna, product specialist with General Motors. So one of the protesters out here is John Walsh, has recently been to Detroit. John, what do you want to tell us about the situation there?
What's happening today, Jamie, is that 76,000 signatures, international signatures on petitions in support of the injured Colombian workers are being delivered to GM World Headquarters at the Renaissance Center. Those come from all over the world, U.S., Colombia, Canada, Australia, Europe. There were many from the U.S., but also many worldwide. So GM's worldwide market is affected, their image worldwide is affected by the injustice they continue to perpetuate against this small group of workers in Colombia.
The sign this protester's holding up is says 540 days in front of U.S. Embassy. And how many days of the hunger strike?
65th day, I believe, of the hunger strike for Jorge Parra in his effort to get General Motors to negotiate in good faith to resolve the issue of the workers that have been fired from General Motors Bogota, Colombia plant after incurring injuries and medical conditions that would not allow them to keep working. They haven't gotten any medical care. They haven't gotten any workers' compensation.
Injuries that took place on the work from floor.
In the workplace, that's correct. Jorge worked for 7 years in the plant, and before he was fired, they did not have the technology to help with the heavy lifting and stuff. And since he was fired because of the ruckus that he created, they did improve the conditions in the plant. But now they're leaving those folks who had to work under those bad working conditions and sustain injuries and bad medical conditions. They're left out on the street without any workers' compensation, without any medical care, without any way to feed their families. And all they want is to be retrained, to continue to work in the company, make a living wage, and be treated humanely and fairly.
And currently, Jorge is on a hunger strike in Detroit. What's he doing there now?
Right now, the auto show, which we're right across the street from here in Portland, is going on in Detroit. And of course, because Detroit is a big car manufacturer place, it's a big deal there. So there's a lot of actions, and we're doing it in solidarity here and are going to send video and notice of what we've been doing here.
Now, I just spoke with a representative of General Motors inside at the auto show. Her name is Dionne Chambers, and she said she doesn't know anything about this situation.
Well, why does that not surprise me? It's a sad reality that even though these workers' rights issues are really global and they're really connected, because the same things that are happening in Colombia are starting to happen here in the United States. And until people see that connection, we're going to be suffering the same consequences. And the fact that General Motors or the American people in general are not aware of this, despite the fact that we bailed them out with our tax money, and despite the fact that we own part of the company, we don't realize that they're mistreating workers throughout the world, and we're next.
Thank you, Greg Margolis, Jamie Partridge for the KBOO News.
The environmental group Greenpeace has published a report called The Point of No Return, outlining the biggest threats to the climate. At the top of the list is the planned expansion of coal mining and export terminals in the Pacific Northwest. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Bethany Cotton of the local branch of Greenpeace.
In your group's report, The Point of No Return, what is the top threat to the climate right now?
The Point of No Return report looks at 14 planned coal, oil, and gas projects all around the world. And the report identifies the Pacific Northwest coal export proposals as the single largest threat to the climate globally of any project in the United States.
What is the potential impact of the coal export terminals if they move forward as planned?
It's really quite catastrophic. The analogy that is drawn in the report is that just the expansion of coal exports in the U.S. alone would produce 420 million tons of carbon emissions, which every year, which is actually more than the entire country of Spain produces per year. And that would be the case by 2020.
And that's just this project in the Pacific Northwest?
It's the five proposals to export coal from the Pacific Northwest.
We hear about numbers like 350, the 350.org movement pushes for a return to 350 parts per million, a reduction of our carbon emissions to that level. And your report talks about a carbon budget. What exactly do you mean by that?
So that's basically what we can really afford. And it's similar to the analysis around 350 parts in the atmosphere. It's a similar concept that there's just only so much we can afford before we reach a point that climate change impacts are beyond any possibility of control. And we have runaway real impacts of that that will include extreme weather events, destruction of communities and property and the environment, and real economic turmoil, as well as just very extreme human suffering.
Now, the extreme weather events that you mentioned and the storms and the drought are all things that President Obama mentioned in his inaugural address on Monday. Do you feel that with his focus on climate change, there will be the political capital in Washington to make these type of changes during his second term?
No, he did say that, and that was extremely heartening. It's something that obviously we should have been talking about a lot more for the last 4 years. And as we move forward, certainly hope that it's really indicative that there will be real movement on this. But it's also something that we need to address regionally and locally as well. And it's totally imperative that these coal export proposals be stopped.
What is the status of the local coal export terminal for the Portland area? What are people doing to organize locally?
So there's an incredible amount of organizing happening here locally and throughout the region. Just recently, in the last 6 weeks, over 10,000 people in Oregon and Washington, and folks came from Idaho and Montana to testify at a series of hearings that were held in Washington and Oregon about the coal export proposals. That's a totally unprecedented public show of very deep concern about these proposals. We also, just yesterday, a public comment period ended for the proposal up in Bellingham, Washington, and 100,000 people submitted comments, which, again, is totally unprecedented. Folks can visit the PowerPath Coal website, which is the coalition of more than 100 conservation, community, faith, and recreation and business groups throughout the region that are working to stop coal export proposals, and find a lot more information about the work that's going on here. And it's very important right now that people talk to the governor and call Governor DeSauber and write to him and tell him that all pending permits for those proposals should be denied at the state level.
And again, that website, powerpastcoal.org, for upcoming events regarding the coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest. Again, I've been speaking with Bethany Cotton with the local branch of Greenpeace, the international environmental organization. This is Jinka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Up to 40% of employees in Portland don't receive a single day of paid sick leave, allowing them to stay home when they're ill. On January 31st, the Portland City Council will hold a public hearing on creating standards for paid and unpaid sick leave. Commissioner Amanda Fritz has proposed a rule that would require all Portland businesses to provide sick leave if they don't give employees at least 1 week off each year. Employers already providing at least 40 hours of leave for vacation or illness would not be affected by the proposed rule. As currently written, the proposal requires all private employers in Portland and the City of Portland to give employees 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours worked, up to 40 hours per year. Any person working more than 240 hours a year would be able to accrue days of sick leave under the rule. Businesses with at least 6 employees would be required to provide paid leave, while smaller companies would have to provide unpaid leave. The first information session to discuss the proposed sick leave rule is tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Portland building at Southwest 5th and Main.
We are now in the second week of the trial of local teen Mohammed Mohammed, and KBOO News is continuing its live coverage from the federal court in Portland. Mohammed is charged with allegedly attempting to blow up the Christmas tree lighting at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland in 2010. But his attorneys argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents, who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer is at the courthouse and joins us live for an update. Joe, you've talked a bit over the last week about evidence that was brought forward by the defense, but not allowed to be seen by the jury. Can you talk about what kind of evidence the jury has not been allowed to see so far?
Well, as far as I can tell, there's really three layers of evidence. One, which the jury is not allowed to see at all, are internal FBI pre-meetings, meetings that are planning undercover operations, and then the debriefs afterwards. These are not allowed at all. The sort of middle category are the so-called outtakes, where the FBI neglected to turn off their tape player after the defendant left. And these are really very revealing, and they're not allowed to be shown to the jury. However, if the FBI agent on the stand directly contradicts an outtake, then the defendant can play the tapes. And these are thought to be incredibly damaging for the prosecution because they show a much different agent. They show the agent celebrating after they hooked the kid, and they use a lot of profanity, and it's like a sports locker room, which is very different from how the agents are portrayed both in the field and how the agents are portraying themselves on the witness stand.
Thank you. So what testimony did the jury get to see today?
Today started with the government calling Special Agent John Halleck. Mr. Halleck is a bomb specialist, and he built the November 4th test bomb that was detonated outside of Corvallis and the Pioneer Square fake bomb. Mr. Knight, for the prosecution, asked about construction details of the fake bomb and the destructive capabilities. Were it real? It seems like the point of that was to make it seem kind of scary. And Ms. Hayes, for the defense, crossed that the defendant didn't have anything to do with making the fake bomb. He bought a couple of cell phones and some electronics that almost provided a second of comic relief as part of his undercover operations. And to show his savvy, the defendant included some stereo components in with the shopping list that it was given to him by the FBI agents. And this bomb expert included that into the design of the fuse for the bomb somehow. Ms. Hayes asked, "Can you build one of those out of anything?" And he said he couldn't build one out of his watch, but somehow was able to incorporate the stereo equipment that the kid included in one of the packages. After that, the government called FBI agent Elvis Chan. Chan was the undercover agent Youssef's handler, and he was present at that famous July 30th meeting where the tape recorder failed. And for the government, Chan testified that he was 20 yards away at the DoubleTree Hotel, Embassy Suites, hotel, when Youssef first met with the defendant, and he was listening in on a transmitter. And so he was testifying about that, and this is one of the most important meetings of the case, and we don't have any physical evidence. It also came out in cross-examination that Agent Chan destroyed his personal notes 2 days after it for some unknown reason. The case really does revolve around this meeting. The defense is entrapment. The facts are not disputed, so it's all about state of mind. The defense is saying that he was trained for that meeting. The FBI agents planted the idea of Pioneer Square into his head. They planted the idea of action in the U.S., and he was just a hapless kid.
So what stage is the trial in now, and how long is it likely to continue?
Well, tomorrow we're going to hear from another FBI agent, the first civilian testimony, and some expert witnesses. But I did want to mention that we heard from an agent, Isaac DeLong, today. He was on the FBI JTTF. And it was interesting for me is that the FBI didn't know what to do with the kid at first. And they were assessing him for a possible undercover role, send him undercover and get information out. The assessment came back that because of his instability and immaturity, he would jeopardize any undercover operation. I thought that was strong for the defense.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with KBOO reporter Joe Meyer, reporting live from outside the federal courtroom in Portland, where Mohammed Mohammed is facing the potential of life in prison if found guilty of terrorism charges.
At today's city council meeting in Portland, the city authorized $1.6 million for the construction of a boathouse to be used by emergency services boats on the Willamette and Columbia Rivers. Also approved by the council today was an item authorizing retirement funds to be paid to a firefighter who is currently in the midst of legal proceedings challenging a decision by the city that ordered him to return to work after medical leave. Here's a clip of the Portland City Attorney Jim Van Dyke explaining the city's position on the case.
The matter before you is an ordinance to comply with an order that we received from the Employment Relations Board in December of 2012, and it arises in a ongoing dispute that the city has with a grievance that was filed by one of the unions regarding firefighter Thomas Hurley. Without going through all the background to this particular dispute, let me try to just summarize it briefly. the city, pursuant to some reforms to the FPD&R system in 2006, instituted a return to work program. Mr. Hurley was ordered to return to work. He did not. The city took some action against him at that time to take him off the medical layoff list. That decision was grieved by the union. An arbitrator in 2010 ruled in his favor and not only reinstated him back to the position that he was in when the city took its action against him, but also ordered the city to pay him, and not the fund, but the city, to pay him back disability benefits over a three-year period of time. Subsequently, this city council adopted a resolution in 2010 that directed the city attorney's office to defend this case, and that's what we've been doing, and it currently is before the Oregon Court of Appeals, and we're waiting for a decision. Our office has looked into asking the Employment Relations Board for a stay of this order while it's on appeal, and we have concluded that we do not have the legal basis to ask for a stay. The ordinance also authorizes the city and the city attorney's office to try to recover those payments if the Court of Appeals rules in our favor.
That was Portland City Attorney Jim Van Dyke speaking at today's City Council meeting.
Public employees of Oregon State now have access to health insurance for medically necessary sex reassignment surgeries, according to a recent lawsuit. Oregon Court of Appeals Clerk Alec Esquivel sued the Public Employees Benefits Board in June of 2011 after the group refused to cover a doctor-recommended hysterectomy. PEBB policy at the time prohibited coverage of sexual disorders, including the so-called gender identity disorder. The state recently settled the case out of court on January 14th, agreeing to pay Esquivel $36,000, as well as covering all future treatment. The Public Employees Benefits Board also changed their policies to cover any operation or treatment that a doctor says is medically necessary. The City of Portland had already made these changes to their coverage of public employees in June of last year when Esquivel filed the lawsuit.
The TriMet Board of Directors today ordered the head of TriMet to address the issue of driver fatigue without waiting for the approval of the driver's union. Current TriMet scheduling rules allow bus drivers to work up to 22 hours in a 24-hour period. This has led to concerns about drivers falling asleep at the wheel. Both TriMet and the driver's union have submitted stopgap proposals to address the issue until a new union contract can be finalized. Both proposals seek to limit the maximum hours worked per day and include a minimum time lapse between shifts. But today, board members urged TriMet General Manager Neil McFarlane to act unilaterally to speed up the process. TriMet has been involved in negotiations with the drivers' union since the collective bargaining agreement expired in 2009. McFarlane is scheduled to meet with union officials to discuss the TriMet proposal on January 31st.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by The Underground at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy, with a chance of rain and a high temperature of 43 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 5:24. Time now for daily talent commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you are sensitive to stories of human suffering and economic hardship, let me warn you that the following report contains materials that could be upsetting, so discretion is advised. It's about a fellow named Jamie. He lives in New York, and he had a very rough go in 2012 with a large financial institution. And, as you can imagine, such behemoths can be heartless, so it's tough to stand up to them. The giant in this case is J.P. Morgan Chase, Wall Street's biggest bank, and it went after poor Jamie Dimon hard. In the end, the bank took more than half of his income. It was bitterly painful, but thanks to the human spirit, Jamie's story turned from sad to uplifting. He was down, but not out, because luckily, J.P. Morgan is his bank. Yes, he's the CEO. And even having his previous year's income slashed by 53%, he will still take home $11.5 million in pay for his labors last year. Plus, he keeps his job. It's a miraculous ending, considering that one of the bank's exotic trading divisions under Jamie's CEO-ship lost a whopping $6.2 billion last year due to finagling, incompetence, or both. Federal authorities are still investigating. Yet, the board of directors didn't can Diamond because, as it explained to regulators, he had, quote, accepted responsibility for the management failures that led to the stunning losses. Wow, he cost investors six big ones. But because he said, in effect, my bad, his bungling gets an $11.5 million reward, which the board says is his punishment. And get this, $10 million of that punishment was awarded to him as a bonus. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a wonderful morality tale this is for America's children. If you make a mess of something, boys and girls, just tell your parents to give you the Jamie Dimon punishment.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The family of the late Junior Seau has sued the National Football League, claiming the former linebacker's suicide was tied to brain disease caused by head trauma he sustained during his 20 seasons in the NFL. Seau was posthumously diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. The wrongful death lawsuit filed today in California Superior Court in San Diego, where he played for 13 seasons, claims the NFL hid potential dangers of repetitive blows to the head. The suit claims Seau developed CTE from the repeated head trauma and accuses the NFL of deliberately concealing evidence of the risks of traumatic brain injuries. Seau killed himself with a gun in May 2012 at age 43. More than 3,800 players have sued the NFL over head injuries over the past 5 years. Junior Seau's wife, Gina, and son, Tyler, both say Junior went through wild behavior and mood swings late in his life with signs of depression, insomnia, forgetfulness, and irrationality. The Seaus also filed suit against helmet manufacturer Riddell, Inc., saying the helmets were unsafe.
Google published their semi-annual transparency report today, showing an increase in requests from the United States government for private user data. Of the 8,500 requests made by the U.S. government, 68% were subpoenas made under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Subpoenas under the ECPA do not require any judicial oversight, only that the government feels the information to be relevant to an investigation. As argued by the Justice Department and upheld in court, the ECPA allows government agents to read any email that has been stored on a third-party server for more than 6 months. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act was passed by Congress in 1986 when it was commonplace for emails to be stored on a personal computer rather than archived online by a third party such as with Gmail services. According to the Google report, total requests by American officials have jumped 136% in the past 4 years, with a 70% increase for governments globally.
In Humboldt County, California, 22 acres of old-growth forest were spared from logging after a public outcry. The habitat is home to hundreds of Douglas fir trees and other coniferous trees and is home to many animal species native to the Humboldt County area. Sierra Pacific Industries, the largest private landowner in the state, harvests the most lumber from clear cutting in the state, and KBOO's Zoe White spoke with Justin Augustine, a staff attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, about clear cutting in California.
Now, how long have you been trying to make clear cutting illegal in the state of California?
Well, that predates me, to be honest. It's been going on for over a decade. I've been working on it for about 5 years now, and unfortunately, we've not yet been successful, but hopefully one of these days soon, clear-cutting will be a thing of the past.
What is the largest company that is benefiting from business practices like clear-cutting and like this kind of logging that completely eradicates forests and natural habitats for species like the spotted owl and for Douglas fir trees?
Here in California, the main, or pretty much the only company that's doing clear-cutting on an extensive basis with Sierra Pacific Industries. They operate not only in Douglas fir country on the coast here in Humboldt County, but also throughout interior Northern California and throughout the Sierra Nevadas and all of those places. Clear-cutting is their primary method of operation.
What states do you principally operate in? Are you exclusively a California-based organization, or do you operate in other states on the West Coast or possibly in other parts of the country or in other countries?
We work worldwide when it comes to oceans. We have projects that go on in Australia right now, so we're throughout the world. Our forest work is primarily focused on the public lands and private lands of the western U.S., California, Oregon, Arizona, New Mexico, but we keep abreast of these issues throughout the world.
Your mission statement states, at the Center for Biological Diversity, we believe that the welfare of human beings is deeply linked to nature. In what way?
Well, pretty much every aspect of our existence is rooted in having a sound environment, whether that's clean water, clean air, or just having a multitude of species out there that we can interact with and be part of. A lot of people try to focus on this supposed dichotomy between economy and the environment, when to me, our economy is really just a subset of the environment, and it could not exist but for having a sound environment.
That was KBOO's Zoe White speaking with Justin Augustine with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Sources say Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta is lifting the Pentagon ban on women serving in combat roles and will announce the changes tomorrow. A senior defense official spoke anonymously to Associated Press on the changes, which will open up hundreds of thousands of frontline positions to women for the very first time. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have apparently already recommended this move. The Armed Services will also have until January of 2016 to argue that some positions, such as Special Operations